Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Hello there, it's Justin Brierley bringing you your midweek dose of Unbelievable, a classic replay from the archives, and we've retrieved another treasure from the back catalogue to get you thinking today. Today's show was first broadcast in August 2010. Sarah Wootton of Dignity in Dying appears opposite George Pitcher and Paul Badham, two Anglican priests on two sides of the debate on euthanasia and assisted dying. This topic looks likely to be raised again in Parliament in the coming year, so look out for more coverage of this on Unbelievable in due course. For more from our regular Weekend Unbelievable show, videos, resources and more, do check out the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Well, thank you, lady and gentlemen here in the studio, and Paul, who will introduce on the phone a little bit later. But thank you for coming in today. We've certainly covered this topic before. I suppose lots of people do think of this as perhaps a religious issue, because often I think the anti-side of this debate, the ones who say it is wrong to allow people to commit suicide in these circumstances, are doing it because of a religious conviction. But just before we came on air, we were actually having a little conversation about whether this is a Christian or a non-Christian issue. And it might be worth sort of just starting out with that. But let me first of all get a little bit of background to you both. Let me first of all welcome George, who is speaking against euthanasia today. George, you're an Anglican priest. Have you always had a Christian faith in your life? Is it something?
No. I avoided it like the plague, you might say, in my late teens. Though I did what was then called a Divinity A level, and I was meant to go to university to read theology. But when I got up to said college at the university, a don said, "You don't have to have a faith to study theology here, but it helps if you do." And I looked around me, and of course it was all men in those colleges, those sorts of colleges at that time, and they were sort of tall and pale, and I realised they were likely to be training for priesthood, and I ran a mile, and I ran a mile for about the next quarter of a century, I suppose, but I was worn down in the end. Rather as C.S. Lewis describes it, though I make no comparison between myself and C.S. Lewis as a theologian, of course, I gave in, if you like, to faith in the end. And so I returned to church, I suppose, on the 14th of March, 1996, and it was around about the millennium that I thought that I might have a vocation to the priesthood. I never had one before, a vocation, that is. So they kicked its tyres and decided it was a vocation, and we went from there.
Right. And you're also, you seem to have many hats, though. You've been a journalist for a long time as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm a non-stipendary minister, as they used to call us. I think they call us self-supporting ministers now, which sounds like sort of Victorian underwear. But I therefore take my living from secular sources, as many of your listeners will know. So I'm a journalist by background. I ran a, you know, lobbying and spin doctoring company. I had a commercial break for 15 years. And therefore I'm, you know, familiar with some of the lobbying techniques that my debating opponent today, Sarah Wootton, is engaged in at the moment.
How long have you particularly been involved in the whole area of assisted dying and commenting on that?
Well, I have no formal role in it. I don't represent an organisation. I feel as again, so some of your listeners may have had the misfortune to hear before, I take a very passionate and polemical opposition to assisted dying and euthanasia. I mean, I know that Sarah, and she'll speak for herself in a moment, but I know that she wants to distinguish between those things and was very keen to distinguish between those things before we came on air, and was correcting you that they're not a pro-euthanasia organisation. I have to say, though, that that those lines are very blurred.
Well, let's introduce Sarah so she can speak for herself. Sarah Woodson is Chief Executive of Dignity in Dying. Sarah, you're an agnostic, I understand, but for you,
yes,
this isn't a sort of religious issue particularly, is it? This, where does your passion for this particular subject come from yourself?
No, I mean, I don't think it's about religion. I think it's about power. And that's where my passion comes from. I'm interested in the redistribution of power. And in my career, I've worked in organisations that have done that. What I think the crux of this debate is about is who makes the decisions at the end of life. Is it the state? Is it the church? Or is it the individual? And what I want is to have more of an opportunity for the individual to have a say in what happens to them, particularly in the context of evolving medical technology that means that death now is more of a process than an event. So that's what makes me passionate, really, is that people telling others what to do. I'm interested in autonomy, responsibly exercised and balanced against the good of society. But this is the sort of campaign, like many other social reform campaigns that have preceded it. The decriminalisation of homosexuality would be a good example, or even going further back, you know, anti-slavery. These two were similar sorts of campaigns around autonomy versus paternalism.
So you see it in that kind of an arena of, if you like, giving people more rights, more personal freedoms, not seeing the state or a church or any other organisation as holding someone, if you like.
Yeah, I'm trying to redress the balance of power. I mean, as it happens, end of life is very much led by what doctors believe is in someone's best interest. That's the way it has been. But things are changing. I mean, this year we've had the publication of the General Medical Council's guidelines with a real focus on patient choice. The general direction of travel is round about patient autonomy and, you know, if you like, the demand side on the healthcare system. And that's what we're representing. And in fact, our campaign is far wider than assisted dying. We have a charitable partner, a charitable arm that I set up called Compassion in Dying. And that gives people information about what their rights are at the end of life, their legal rights, and gives out free advanced decisions, which used to be called legal living wills, which again give people the right to refuse treatment if they lose competence or consciousness.
George, your book, A Time to Live, you start out talking about, well, you talk about the deaths of both your parents, actually, but you talk about your mother initially and how that affected you as far as her last hours. I mean, obviously, this is the kind of topic which you can both talk about on an academic level, but ultimately strikes with most people at a very personal level, because many people have had the experience of seeing a loved one perhaps ending their life or coming towards the end of their life in some amount of pain. And I think there is a very natural instinct to want to end that pain, for that person not to be in pain. I mean, that is in some sense a very understandable reaction, isn't it? And I'm sure you address that in the book, don't you?
Well, it's certainly understandable because I've been there. You know, I've pleaded with a nurse to end my mother's life, you know, to wash her away on a tide of opiate or something. I think hard cases like that and other cases that have been in the news recently make bad law. So I wouldn't for a moment say that my experience with my own mother's death should prescribe our legislature on the subject. But what I hope to do was to make your point that our opinions are formed out of the personal, obviously, but I do think it's illustrative of a wider point, and the wider point is that that I have no doubt. Well, let me say first of all that I anticipate that Sarah would, and her organisation would say that any intention on my part to get the nurse to kill My mother, when she was unconscious, is no part of their requirement or their policy or their proposals. But I think that's a disingenuous position, because there is no doubt in my mind that that I fulfilled many of the categories that Dignity in Dying and Sarah Wotton and her colleagues represent when they talk about the compassion of my motives. My mother was undoubtedly terminally ill, which is, again, a key category for Dignity in Dying in terms of qualification for what they call an assisted death, which is, you know, a weasel word for an assisted suicide. I've no doubt, too, that my mother, given the option, would have sought to protect us from her final hours early on by asking for it if it was available. And therefore, all that experience with my mother's death would have been entirely different if the kind of proposals in law that Dignity in Dying and Sarah propose had been in place. So it's simply not good enough, frankly, to talk about sort of personal autonomy and choice under these circumstances, because, you know, that being available would have prescribed a very different outcome in that instance, and any number of instances of people dying all over the country all the time.
People may be wondering, what was the outcome then? What did you feel was the difference? Because of the fact that, in fact, your mother didn't, as it were, have an induced death.
Well, in my case, it meant that she that the morphine wore off, that we had some time with her. She was unable to speak, but we were able to say goodbye and to tell her we loved her, and she to indicate that the same applied to us. And, you know, that was the most sort of precious 15 or 20 minutes of my life, and possibly of hers. I didn't know. I was unable to be sure, but my sister as well. Now, I think that there are values and qualities to a death like that running its course, which we simply cannot anticipate. And to get into the idea that it's compassionate to abbreviate or terminate when we think it's right, to empower, as Sarah puts it, people to end life, is to squander some of the most profound insights to living and dying.
I'm sure, Sarah, you probably have a bag of stories that kind of contradict, in a sense, that where your organisation has come into contact with people who, for whom the ability to be able to see a loved one pass away peacefully and without being in pain.
Well, I think it might be a good time, Justin, to bring in some definitions for listeners, because this is a very complex ethical, medical and legal territory, and I think it's important that people understand the different acts we're talking about and also the different laws that govern them. So if people imagine a spectrum of acts here, and if you start off on one side of that spectrum, then you'd start with assisted dying. And I'll give examples of individuals because that might make it realer to people. So assisted dying is assisting a terminally ill, mentally competent adult to shorten the dying process. They are terminally ill at their request. Now, a good example of that would be Diane Pretty, the original case in the early 2000s, who had motor neurone disease, which obviously killed her. Moving along the spectrum, assisted suicide would be the next category, and that is assisting the death of a chronically ill but not dying suffering person if they ask for help. This is all consensual activity, and probably the best known example of that is Daniel James, the rugby player, who, though he said he was suffering unbearably, was not actually dying.
Was not terminally ill in that sense.
Exactly, yes.
Nor is Debbie Purdy terminally ill, is she?
Toby isn't terminally ill.
Nor is Terry Pratchett.
We'll come on to those.
We'll come on to those, yeah.
So, euthanasia, moving further along the spectrum, euthanasia or mercy killing, they're really interchangeable. That's direct action to end a person's life. To enable that person to have a good death, that's what euthanasia means, a good death. Now, that can either be consensual activity, which is voluntary euthanasia, or it can be non-consensual. There can be no consent there, in which case it's non-voluntary. Now, good examples of consensual activity are Heather Pratton, who was on Radio 4 this week on The Choice, so listeners may have heard her story, and Tony Nicholson, the locked-in man who's been on the news recently. Those are examples of that. And non-consensual or non-voluntary euthanasia cases would be Mrs. Inglis, the case of the woman who killed her son with heroin overdoses, tried to twice.
Well, let's cut to the chase here, Sarah. You support them across the board, don't you?
The other example
you support
is
all
George.
These cases, don't you?
The other case is George, with what he was talking about with his mother. Mm. That's a case of non-consensual mercy killing. So the question is, did your mother ask for help? No, that wasn't there. Now, and if you go to the furthest
extreme...
Which
she would have done if there was an earlier opportunity for her to do so.
Beyond that. Let me just finish, George. The one stage beyond that is murder, which obviously we all agree is a heinous crime, self-serving, malicious act. Now, we at Dignity and Dying have thought very carefully about where you draw the line and what the laws should be that govern those acts. There are two laws that govern those acts at the moment. One is the 1961 Suicide Act, and the second one is the 1965 Murder Law. And basically the first two are governed by the 61 Suicide Act and the others are governed by murder law. And what we're calling for at Dignity in Dying is the opportunity for terminally ill, dying, mentally competent adults to have the choice of an assisted death.
Then why?
That's what we're calling for.
Then why support Terry Pratchett when he says that he'd like to his life to be ended when he's no longer mentally competent? Why support Debbie Purdy, who is not terminally ill?
Terry's quite clear on that. Terry's quite clear. I mean, I think... You have to really listen. I don't know whether you listened to his Dimbleby debate. It was a wonderful speech.
I mean, I listened to what he said to the newspapers subsequently, too.
It was a very humane and humorous speech where he really sort of talked from the heart about his fears and his concerns and the difference for him. And I think he had that key phrase, if I could die, I would live. I mean, we'll probably come on to this when we talk about Oregon later.
Well, it's a very religious...
Hang on, let me finish. If people know they have the control, then the quality of their life improves, and if they know they've got that control and choice at the end of life. Just finishing about Terry, Terry's quite clear, and as he says, anyone sensible believes that the law should change to enable terminally ill, mentally competent adults to have the choice of assisted death. That law does not extend to the other cases that I've spent some time trying to explain.
It's very interesting, however, that you should describe the spectrum going all the way from assisted dying at one end to murder at the other, because it's interesting that you should accept that murder is on the same spectrum. Because
it's
once
governed by the same laws, yes.
But you're saying there is an incremental increase to where we get to murder, and I think that many people on this side of the debate would be entirely concerned by your proposition that apparently is on your website and that you put out in your charter that your case is solely for mentally competent, terminally ill patients to end their lives, mm-hmm. when clearly you support people who are neither terminally ill and Debbie Purdy isn't terminally ill.
She
has multiple sclerosis. No, but with respect, you've done huge damage to the Multiple Sclerosis Society and the campaign for looking after people with multiple sclerosis by suggesting that multiple sclerosis is a terminal condition when it isn't.
Well, neither the Multiple Sclerosis Society nor the Multiple Sclerosis Trust think so at all. They both have neutral approaches to assisted dying, and they've used Debbie to fundraise them for them recently. The Multiple Sclerosis Trust has asked me to speak at their conference.
Well, that's certainly not what they've told us. But let me return to the spectrum on multiple sclerosis.
We need to be clear that there are different types of MS.
Are you saying that it's terminal? Are you saying that Debbie Purdy is terminally ill?
She's got primary progressive MS, which means that obviously it's not relapsing, remitting. It's not going to remit at any stage. And in fact,
so she's not terminally ill.
And in fact, the chief executive
so she is
of
not
the
ill,
Multiple Sclerosis Society, Simon Gillespie,
you can avoid the question as long as you like, but she's not terminally ill.
That she will reach a terminal phase.
I mean, is okay.
Everybody on this planet will reach a terminal phase.
You obviously feel though here, George, that the Dignity in Dying is being disingenuous. They're actually supporting euthanasia, not just the far end of the spectrum of
Sarah,
assisted
Sarah
dying.
Sarah herself has given speeches where she's celebrated the long lobbying activity of the organisation with which she works, and it's only recently been called Dignity in Dying, which is a term that she expropriated, rather cynically, I think, from the medical profession, therefore denying the medical profession an argument for its own arguments in palliative care and the promotion of palliative care for dignity in dying. It's a technique of dignity in dying to expropriate compassion.
And what was the name before that?
It was the Voluntary Euthanasia Society, and Sarah is a supporter of voluntary euthanasia. She has made that clear in the past.
No,
in speeches
I haven't.
She has
I've made that quite clear that I'm not.
You said you've been campaigning for this for decades, George's, and for decades it was called the Voluntary Euthanasia Society before it was called Dignity in Dying, Sarah.
George is right that the organisation was formed in 1935, and it was
and
the Voluntary Euthanasia Society.
And you've celebrated its history
Society.
Back to that time.
And also, in 2006, it changed its name. It actually changed its mem and arts, crucially. So its mem and arts very specifically say that we campaign for assisted dying for terminally ill and mentally competent adults
only. Well, I
think
only. We've just demonstrated that you also campaign for people that aren't, when they're not mentally competent and when they're not terminally ill.
I think I've made clear that there is a different cases under law, and that we're very clearly looking for a different kind of legislation.
You mentioned Tony Nicholson, the man who's tragically locked into the after a stroke. Do you support his choice to end his life?
No, I don't call for legislation that would allow disabled people to have the choice of an assisted death. What I do think is that mercy killers, which obviously his wife would be, she would be a consensual mercy killer, shouldn't be treated the same as malicious murderers. So I do think that murder
that's
the point.
Was Kay Gilderdale treated that way when she
was found not guilty by a jury? I think, I mean, this is the crux of it, really. We've got problems here. We've got two laws, Suicide Act and Murder Law, which are nearly half a century old. Things were different when these laws were created, and there's not a jury in the land that would convict these people. And you've got to think about
they
these
convicted the mother the week before the Kay Gilderdale date. Frances Inglis, who had murdered her son. Yeah. They convicted her. Now, those are entirely different cases.
They are.
But what you're doing is eroding the ability of the law to make to distinguish between them.
To
suggest that mercy killing is something that, should be treated differently.
The issue is that our entire judicial process,
Mrs.
the Crown Prosecution Service, Supreme Law Lords, the police...
Can I interrupt here and just say, we do need to talk about the law, and I'd like to move on soon, if we can, to instances where there have been, liberalisation of euthanasia and assisted dying laws, particularly in Oregon and the Netherlands.
And Switzerland.
But... you're listening to Unbelievable. We're talking about the case for and against assisted dying and euthanasia. Reverend George Pitcher is with me. He's been talking recently and especially writing in his book A Time to Live about the case against euthanasia and assisted dying. Sarah Wootton, Chief Executive of Dignity in Dying, a pro-assisted dying organisation, is also with me here in the studio. And it's time to introduce now the Reverend Paul Badham, an Anglican priest who supports assisted dying. We'll hear from him right now, here on the programme that gets you thinking.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
I said at the outset that this isn't a programme where the lines are clearly drawn between a Christian and a non-Christian viewpoint. And to illustrate that, Paul Badham is on the line now. Paul, you wrote a book yourself, Is There a Christian Case for Assisted Suicide? And you support the cause of Dignity in Dying and those who are calling for a liberalisation of the laws in this area. Tell us a little bit of your personal experience here and what led you to your current position as a Christian on this issue.
I think my current position on this situation was brought about through witnessing the terrible death of my parents and grandparents, and indeed of practically everybody whose death I have personal knowledge of. And these experiences led me to believe that the law should be changed for assisted dying. And my book is about assisted dying, not assisted suicide. And I think it's important to keep that distinction.
Are you anti-euthanasia, therefore? Are you anti-euthanasia? I mean, we've had a lot of chat here between George and Sarah about whether George believes, obviously, that Dignity in Dying have more than just assisted dying in their sights. But are you very firm that you're only for assisted dying? You're not for anything more than that?
No, I'm for assisted dying. That when a person is terminally ill and suffering unbearably and repeatedly asks for assistance to die, it would be appropriate for a Christian to help them, to give them that assistance. I think there is no... It seems to me that that is an entirely appropriate case to make. Jesus said that the whole of religious law could be summed up in the requirement to love God and to love our neighbour as ourselves. And his golden rule was always treat others as you would wish to be treated yourself. And since opinion polls repeatedly show that over 75% of people say they would wish to be given an assistance to die if they found themselves suffering unbearably in the final stages of terminal illness. Given that that is what people wish for, then it is something that we should give. And I am particularly struck by the knowledge that many doctors have pacts to help each other out in this way. And it seems to me, and they also, many doctors, make sure that their families have a much more merciful end than other patients. And it seems to me that doctors who give a merciful death to their patients on request should extend this, should treat their patients as they wish to be treated themselves, and as they intend to ensure their loved ones are treated.
Well, thank you for the introduction there to you know, the core argument in your book. And in many ways, George's book is a direct response in some aspect to various aspects of your book, Paul. I was saying that your book, George, your book, A Time to Live, is in some ways a response to George's work, Paul's work even. So what worries you about the way Paul sees this as he's explained it?
Well, in one sense, I'm grateful for Paul Badham's intervention there, because he serves to show what a rich and varied world Anglican theology is. You know, it suits Sarah and her organisation sometimes to portray this as a kind of religious swivel-eyed bigots like me versus compassionate, reasonable, rational secularists. And it's good to know that, you know, there is a variety of debate within the Anglican communion. But if I could, but having said that, I would say that Professor Badham is profoundly and depressingly misguided in his theology. If I can paraphrase his book, and it's always dangerous to paraphrase a book, but nevertheless I'll have a go, he's very significantly saying that because we live with a God who loves us and doesn't want to see us suffer and longs for us to be with him, then we should help them along to be with him. And, that's a short step from somebody saying, I've decided to be with God, so I'm off now, which I don't think is a divine intention whatsoever. If I could just say that I think that, you know, if there's a theodicy, the theology of suffering module at the University of Lampeter, where Professor Badham teaches, I don't think his students are going to be learning very much. It's not a gospel I recognise, because the poor, as they're referred to in the Gospels, and Paul Badham refers to the Gospels there, and let me do so, the poor are clearly not, in translation, the economically poor. They're the alienated, the dispossessed, the marginalised in society. They're the fragile, the elderly, the terminally ill, the lepers, the sick. Even in that world, women. And the Christ that Professor Badham and I both celebrate is the Christ that says that their lives are every bit as image in the image of God as we able-bodied and healthy and the chosen, if you will. Now, you know, what Professor Badham, the Reverend Paul Badham, is proposing is a kind of two-tier world in which we're affirming and confirming in the minds of people that their lives are not worth living. We're agreeing with them. I didn't interrupt you, Paul. Let me finish. it is leading, whether he intends to or not, and frankly, it's only silly theology like Paul Badham's that can lead us to these places. You know, it may not be his intention, but we will get to a place where we are affirming that their lives are not to be cherished, but to be helped with our help to be terminated. And the real moral cowardice here, both on the part of humanists such as Sarah Wootton and on the part of Paul Badham, is that, of course, the assistance to die, as Paul Badham said in his contribution a moment ago, the assistance to die will be required from doctors and nurses. They will be required to either prepare their patients for the process of dying, or confirm that they're ready to die, or even in most cases probably to actually enact the dying process. And that brutalizes them as well as brutalizing the people that are dying. And Paul, I would say that, you know, if you're depending on a Christian narrative, your narrative would end in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Paul, what's your response?
Well, first of all, I would say that it is explicitly part of the Joffe Bill that no doctor can be required to offer any assistance to a person to die, or even to refer them to another doctor. That's absolutely explicit. What I would say.
Where do you think they get the lethal dose from? Then you're a fan of self-administration, aren't you, Paul?
Solely, it's voluntary on the part of the doctors. It's when a doctor wishes to help a person who is crying out for help, who finds their situation unbearable and asks for release from it. And I do not see how one can believe that if one follows Jesus in saying treat others as they wish to be treated, then if a person is suffering unbearably and asking for help to end their suffering, then we should give them that help. And I just do not believe that the idea that if we allow assisted dying, you then slide down a slippery slope to other things. And the key instance here is the case of Switzerland, which has had for 80 years assisted dying, but where there is no movement toward voluntary euthanasia, and where there is the best health care in the world.
That is just a nonsense, Paul. Ludwig Minelli, who heads the Dignitas Clinic, is vehement in his view that the non-terminally ill should be allowed to commit suicide in his clinic if they wish to. So there is a very strong movement there to do so. And as to your slippery slope, I think they're there already. Switzerland hugely regrets having become the death capital of Europe. There are ministers that want the law repealed so that they stop being the destination for people who are non-terminally ill to end their lives. Two Germans recently were assisted to die in their car in a lay-by on a Zurich bypass. Where's the dignity in that?
The question, it seems to me, is that, yes, the Swiss do not want people from other countries to go to Switzerland to end their lives. But
you're saying they didn't regret introducing it at all?
On the question of Switzerland, I encourage anyone to Google the internet sites of the World Health Organization. You will see from there that Switzerland has 18.3 beds per 1,000 compared with only 4 in Britain, that the Swiss on average live 2.5 years longer than we do, and that the Swiss live with terminal illness longer than we do. The fact that the Swiss law is merciful in allowing people who wish to end their lives to be given assistance to do so does not in any way put pressure on people in Switzerland to ask for it.
Well, it certainly clears those inconvenient people out of the health system.
Something I'd like to address is certainly George's criticism of your actual theodicy, you know, your theology of suffering, Paul, which he says is simply not the gospel he recognises. And one thing that comes across in the book is that you feel that we're perhaps putting dignity in the wrong place, George. Would that be correct? That there's a dignity in bringing people even through suffering, the way in which we are able to minister to them and be there for them is something very akin to what Jesus in God in Jesus Christ does for us in the cross, and that we somehow miss something if we think that life is really about getting rid of dispatching people just so that they don't have to suffer, that we're missing something big there.
Well, there is great dignity in independence. There is great dignity in lives lived self-sacrificially. There is great dignity in people bearing their suffering with courage. There is, you know, the words dignity and compassion are very often expropriated by the pro-euthanasia lobby as if they belong to them and not to anyone else. And the idea, frankly, that the only dignity that is available is a kind of personal autonomy where we exercise power over our own lives without any reference to the idea that lives are lived and defined in definition with in the definition of their relationship with others, which is, you know, what life and what I thought the gospel message was about.
We'll come back to Paul, but Sarah, you want to?
Well, I mean, I'm interested in George's view of suffering. I mean, he may be right that there is reward there, but it is always, of course, very easy to be sanguine about other people's suffering. I mean, my question to George is, why do some people have to suffer in order to protect others, particularly when you've got a situation in some countries which you can demonstrate that you don't need to have either a duty to suffer or a duty to die?
Yeah, well, let me answer that question. The fact is that in the jurisdictions, and I hope we're coming on to talk about the jurisdictions where this has been legalised, and they very largely regret it.
No.
But in the jurisdictions where assisted suicide, or right the way through to Holland and euthanasia, has been legalised, the focus of attention, once death has become a clinical treatment option, palliative care either withers on the vine or changes its definition and becomes something else. And Paul was referring to it there in Switzerland, where the inconveniently terminally ill are swept from the health stage. What we're looking at is a circumstance in which death has become a clinical treatment, and palliative care has either become something else or has disappeared or withered on the vine.
Can we just define palliative care for those who may...
Palliative care is the relief of suffering. What we should be aiming for is to pour all our effort, all our resources, all our attention into our world-leading palliative care in the UK. And that is threatened by the proposals that Paul and Sarah want to introduce.
Are you suggesting then that in those places where it has been liberalised, in the Netherlands, in the state of Oregon, etc., palliative care is declining, that people aren't investing into it in the way that it's been invested here in the UK?
Well, certainly we have world-leading palliative care in the UK. We have a fantastic hospice movement. And once we get to a stage where we're saying, well, you know, there's no point in continuing to relieve this suffering at the end, because when people get to this suffering, which is a, you know, minute proportion of the deaths that occur, and one day will be no proportion of the deaths that occur, because with genetic advances in medicine, with advances in palliative care, all the senior palliative care doctors I spoke to in putting together my book confirmed that there will come a time when no one need die in pain. But of course we won't get there if we bring the process forward with Paul Badham's rather foolish, I think, proposal that when people want to die, they should be helped to do so, or indeed Sarah suggesting that we introduce assisted dying, stroke assisted suicide.
I mean, can I come back on that? Because I challenge George on the facts around that, the actual facts, and I've got a report here, an Economist Intelligence Unit that was just published last month on the 14th of July, which shows that countries where assisted dying is legal or lawful, palliative care flourishes. I mean, you know, our UK is the top.
Palliative care becomes something that is...
Belgium is in the top. Netherlands is in the top. Netherlands, for example, is the fourth best palliative care in Europe.
This is because
Oregon in the States have got brilliant palliative care.
Sarah, this is largely because they're people that are being treated before they get to the stage where they're given an assisted suicide or euthanized.
That's not true.
Well, how would you know?
George.
Because they've been helped to die or euthanized. So they're not the most extreme cases that we're addressing.
Absolutely not true. Does Paul want to come in?
I think Paul wants to come in, yes. Go ahead, Paul.
The key evidence here is the evidence of the Oregon Hospice Association, because they lobbied passionately against their bill and went all the way to the Supreme Court to have the bill annulled. But because it took 8 years to get to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court ultimately agreed that Oregon had the right to pass that law, the Oregon Hospice Association issued a new statement saying they were glad they had lost their case, because in the 8 years that the law had been in existence, absolutely none of our dire predictions had been realized. Instead, the number of people who died in hospice care had risen from 21 to 51.
Because you're removing the most extreme cases of suffering from the equation.
The evidence of the people in Oregon, that's their hospice association, and we need to take note of the evidence of the Royal Dutch Medical Association, and we need to take note of the fact that seeing how it works in Oregon, the neighboring states of Washington and Montana have changed their laws, and in the Netherlands, the other Benelux countries, Luxembourg and Belgium, have changed their laws. The people who have seen it at work at close hand have seen that it works and doesn't have the negative consequences that people believe may flow.
Obviously, George focuses to some extent on the issue of Oregon, where they did introduce a bill and a law allowing assisted suicide.
Assisted dying. In Oregon specifically.
Okay.
Again, it's assisted dying for terminally ill, mentally competent adults only.
Okay. But you're very critical of this, George, because you feel that there's so much leeway, the way these things can be interpreted, the way that people can ask for different doctors' assessments and things, and also the statistics in terms of how many people have then been assisted to die in Oregon. Mm. You believe that there is a negative trend coming out of that.
Well, I know Paul Badham is a big fan of practices in Oregon, as is Sarah, and they use it as a kind of model regularly. So I'd be interested in their response to. I've heard Paul, for instance, say that if we were to introduce assisted dying, assisted suicide. You know, whatever weasel words you want to apply to it, then self-administration of the lethal dose by the person who's applied for their own suicide would be the way to go. Well, you know, depending on which research you accept from Oregon, either 1 in 4 or 1 in 5, between 1 in 4 and 1 in 5 people who are committing suicide in that way in Oregon are clinically depressed. So the system that Paul Badham is a big fan of is anything around 25% of people committing suicide at a later date, when they may have been manipulated by other people, when 25% of them are certainly clinically depressed, or maybe dying in loneliness, are taking that lethal dose. That is the system that Paul would propose introducing to the UK.
Can we get into Oregon, the detail
Oregon,
on that,
Oregon also, Oregon also has this doctor shopping system whereby you can go and apply for your assisted suicide and get assisted in finding a doctor or the two doctors that will approve your intention to commit suicide. They will be helped by Dignity in Dying sister organisation in Oregon. They're members of the same worldwide federation of pro euthanasia organisations.
We're not a member actually, but anyway.
Well, your name was on the list when I last looked at it.
Not anymore.
Well, okay, you've taken it off. Well, again, we're making progress. But an organisation that very much fulfils the same purposes in Oregon as Dignity in Dying in the UK is saying, come with us and we'll find you a doctor that will rubber stamp your application for a suicide.
You want to look at the fine detail
yes.
there.
I think we need to look at the actual situation in Oregon. So you take the state of Oregon, about 30,000 people a year die in Oregon each year. And out of that 30,000, the numbers of people who have an assisted death is between, it's stabilised at between 40 to 60 people every year. I mean, it started off at 15 people. It was a partial year, 12 years ago. But it stabilised at about that number, which is less than two out of every 1,000. It's quite interesting, actually, if you look at a journey and how many people consider having an assisted death and how many people actually do it. So out of that 30,000, it's only 10,000, 9,800 who actually consider a prescription. That's quite a large amount. Obviously, a third of that number who die. Only 1,000 talk to a doctor about the prescription. Only 85 received the prescription, and of that, only 49 used it. This is a particular case study in 2007, looking at the numbers in 2007. And I think it's really interesting that each year, 40% of people who receive this prescription don't actually use it. And that keys back very much to my earlier point that if people know they've got choice and control at the end of life, that actually frees them up. It gives them the opportunity to enjoy the quality of life that they have left.
No, on the contrary, it suggests that they shouldn't have been prescribed the drug in the first place, because you're giving a lethal dose to people that didn't need it because they've chosen to live.
The reason why they've chosen to live is Terry Pratchett's point, because he can die. So coming back to the depression point, I'm glad you mentioned this. This is some research by Dr. Ganzini in 2008. And Dr. Ganzini looked, it was published in the Journal of Palliative Care Medicine, and it's worth saying that in the editorial in that research journal, it said quite clearly that people should be screened for depression, that it certainly wasn't advocating that there shouldn't be an assisted dying program in Oregon. And basically, Dr. Ganzini looked at 18 people in 2008 who were actually involved in asking for an assisted death. And out of those 18, six had symptoms of depression. And the way that she measured depression was she looked at feelings of anxiety. She looked at lack of sleep patterns. She looked at inability to eat. Now, these are all symptoms that might well, one would add, be present when somebody is terminally ill and in the last few weeks and days of their life. But to extrapolate from that, to say that one in three, it is one in three, George.
Because,
six goes into
I suppose George's contention is this a slippery slope towards essentially granting people the right to kill themselves if they're feeling down?
Justin, I won't have the slippery slope. It isn't the beginning of getting anywhere. Just as soon as you introduce this stuff, you're there. And that's the experience of jurisdictions. It isn't beginning to slip down something that gets us to a dangerous place. You're already in the dark valley as soon as you introduce
this legislation. But isn't Sarah saying it's silly to suggest that this is somehow an immediate open door to people being able to take their own lives if they're feeling depressed? This is not that these cases of depression can easily be linked to the fact that people are in their last stages of life, that they're in some kind of form of terminal illness.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't want to make that call, would you? You know, they may be depressed or they may not be. I mean, the fact is that, and let's define the nature of their depression. I mean,
The Journal of Palliative Care felt they shouldn't change the programme.
But Sarah, I'm astonished, frankly, even from the Chief Executive of Dignity and Dying, that you should be so glib about the numbers that you should say it's only a few of these people that are doing this, and it's only a few who take the lethal dose who are actually using it. And so on. I mean, as it happens, if those numbers, and all this is in the book, if those numbers were extrapolated into an experience in the UK, given the relative populations of Oregon and the UK, you know, we'd be looking at something like 1,000 a year killing themselves in this way.
Out of half a million people who die in the UK.
Yeah, so it hardly matters. Only 1,000 people, whom may be clinically depressed,
I'm being glib about,
lonely,
George,
manipulated by
well, your listeners don't
relatives.
Want to hear us speaking over each other.
It's an important point as well, which often comes up in other debates as well, and I'll perhaps let Paul respond to this, that there is a danger here, many people say, Paul, that the right to die becomes a duty to die, that especially the frail and elderly who feel there may be a burden on their families, etc., may feel that, essentially, once the option becomes open, that is one that they are forced to take because they feel that they're being an inconvenience, a burden. What's your response to that argument?
My response to that is that it's incompatible with the evidence that people, say, in Switzerland, live 2.5 years longer than people in Britain, and that they live longer with terminal illness. And the other point, which hasn't yet been brought into the discussion at all, which is that one needs to compare what happens in legislations which allow assisted dying and what happens in legislations which do not allow assisted dying. According to an editorial in the British Medical Journal for the 29th of September 2007, people are more likely to be killed without their consent in countries that forbid assisted dying than in those that permit it. And that's a very interesting finding. The point is that people, the law legally allowing assisted dying and providing a good regulation of it can actually ease the situation and make it less likely that people will be killed against their will in terminal illness.
That's absolutely right. I mean, in the Netherlands, the rate of non-voluntary euthanasia has actually halved since legalisation. It's gone from 1,000 cases to 500 cases every year. And it's interesting. I mean, there is doctor-assisted dying, if you like to call it like that, or non-voluntary, sometimes voluntary euthanasia. In every country in the world, it is going on. The question is, do you regulate it? Do you make it more transparent? Or do you push it underground?
That's just not true. You know, to suggest that a medical profession is killing people is a huge insult to the medical professions professionals that are working on the preservation of life. And let's talk about Holland, shall we? Shall we talk about Holland? Shall we talk about a country whose legislature in this regard has become so morally eroded that a senior doctor can give evidence to the Joffe House of Lords inquiry in 2005, which was meant to support the introduction of assisted suicide legislation into the UK, whilst its supporters from Dignity and Dying and from, you know, in the Houses of Parliament were running around saying it's in the bag and it's going to happen. It was meant to support that. But one of the key evidences from Holland, of which there was a lot which was really very offensive, was that we euthanise now people who are unable to make a decision or ask for it themselves. That includes people in comas, and we've seen instances recently of people in comas who have indicated with their eyes that they'd certainly want to carry on living. And God help us, newborn babies who they say can't express an opinion themselves.
Yeah, but that happens in every country in the world with an advanced medical service. Some newborn babies are allowed to die. That happens in every country.
That's not allowed to die. That's euthanized, I'm talking about, Paul.
In the case of people who are in comas. But doctors do have to decide at what point the life support machines should be switched off.
That's entirely different.
This is a problem that affects every advanced medical service in the world.
We are going to have to take a quick break here, and we'll pick up the conversation again in the final section of our discussion. Lots and lots of points to pick up on there. And my guest, George Pitcher, who's the Anglican priest, author of the book A Time to Live, the case against euthanasia and assisted dying, has been making a strong case against any change in the law towards a liberalisation of our view of assisted dying and suicide. Sarah Wootton, Chief Executive of Dignity in Dying, has been putting the case for assisted dying. And Paul Badham, who we just heard on the phone there, the Anglican priest who has written a book in support of assisted dying too. We'll continue to discuss these things and draw our conversations to a close in just a moment here on the programme that gets you thinking.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
A time to live or a time to die? That's the question today as we look at the case for and against assisted dying and euthanasia. We've been hearing very lively interactions this afternoon between the Reverend George Pitcher, an Anglican priest and author of the book A Time to Live, the case against euthanasia and assisted dying. Links to that book and where you can get it, obviously, with the podcast of this programme. Sarah Wootton, Chief Executive of Assisted Dying Group Dignity in Dying, has also been putting the case for assisted dying very cogently on the programme today as well, and will of course include links to her organisation with this podcast as well, so you should be able to look at both sides of the debate. And Paul Badham continues to join us, the Anglican priest who supports assisted dying and author of his own book in support of that. So Folks, just as we come to a conclusion on today's programme, something that we haven't really touched on that much as yet is where law currently stands, because at the moment, rather than there being a bill being tabled as such, it's more about clarification, I understand, of what the law is as regards to someone who does, for instance, take someone to or give someone a fatal dose or help them in their dying moments or whatever. Now, I'm no expert on this, so I'll come to you first, Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
The Department of Public Prosecutions is what we're talking about here.
The Director of Public Prosecutions, so the head of the Crown Prosecution Service. As a result of the Debbie Purdy case, he was ordered by the Supreme Court to set out the factors that he takes into account, basically when deciding to prosecute somebody or not prosecute them for assisting suicide. And he came up with a policy around this. And basically what he's saying is that compassionate assisters will not be prosecuted. It's quite clear he hasn't changed the law. But it's also quite clear that if you are compassionately assisting somebody, and there is more detail clearly around this policy, then you won't be prosecuted for doing so. So from my perspective, I think we have a problem, because we've still got the 1961 Suicide Act, which, though nearly 50 years out, since it was formed, it actually still threatens people with up to 14 years in prison. But the law is clearly, it's not respected or observed by the general public, by juries, by police. And I think this is a real problem for this country, because laws exist for a purpose. They're there to protect us. And what I'd say is, you've got a situation where people can go most often to Switzerland, but people can also have an assisted suicide in this country. There is no reason to stop that. In fact, there was a recent case, the case of Michael Bateman, that the Crown Prosecution Service ruled on, who helped his wife to die, and he too was not prosecuted because he fitted all the criteria for being a compassionate assister. So what I'm saying is that the law needs to move on. It needs to decide where the safeguards are. There are two problems. There are no safeguards about who goes to Switzerland. There's only a retrospective assessment of whether they've committed a crime or not when somebody has already died. And also, there is no safe, if you like, no medically assisted method of suicide available in this country. So effectively, what the law has done has effectively decriminalised compassionate amateur assistance, but still professional assistance is a crime.
It's an interesting kind of area that we're caught up in then. What's your response to the way that currently the legislation has gone in terms of the DPP issuing this clarification on this, George?
Well, it wasn't the Supreme Court that, you know, I don't want to be pedantic, it wasn't the Supreme Court
that ruled on
it. It was the Law Lords, which have now been scrapped, and it was a ginger group of sympathetic Law Lords within the Law Lords that directed the Director of Public Prosecutions to look into it. But I think the real point here is that the movement in this country for introducing assisted suicide legislation or euthanasia, you know, those who are in favour of euthanasia, who want that, are looking at a kind of incremental steps to getting what they want. They've failed to get it through the legislature properly in Parliament, which is where our laws should be made.
Two bills failed.
Yeah, Joffe in 2005, Faulkner last year. I mean, you know. And we can look at Faulkner, but, you know, in a sense, let's not. Having failed in the proper process of law in the legislature, the lobby group then turned its attention, once the Law Lords had directed the Director of Public Prosecutions to, in quote marks, clarify the law. What they wanted to do was to attenuate Parliament. What they wanted to do was to undermine the Suicide Act 1961 by having the DPP, if you like, rule in favour of circumstances in which it would be okay to assist a suicide. The DPP came up with draft proposals which had all sorts of things in it, like saying that the condition had to be that a person was terminally ill, like the conditions that Dignity and Dying refer to for somebody who should qualify for an assisted death. You know, that doctors and nurses could participate in it and so on. because of the outcry from disabled groups, from the palliative care industry in this country, from hospices, from doctors, from medical organisations, all the medical organisations, because of the submissions that went, no, 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 we shouldn't allow this to happen, most of those proposals were withdrawn. And the DPP has come out. Effectively, what happened is that the pro-euthanasia lobby and so as not to misrepresent Sarah today, the pro-assisted dying lobby, they shot themselves in the foot, frankly. The DPP has clarified the circumstances under which the intention of somebody who takes somebody to die or assists them to die will be taken into account. But now that the law is clarified, there is no reason on earth for this to return to Parliament to have and to have the Suicide Act of 1961 repealed in any sense. As Gordon Brown, as Prime Minister before he left Downing Street, made clear, the law is now clear. There is no case for bringing this before Parliament again.
This is where I think George's argument gets a little bit disingenuous. He's accused me of that earlier. I mean, the result of the DPP's policy is that we have the most permissive regime in the world. Now, you know, anybody can go to Switzerland. There are no criteria. Effectively, that's what Charlie Faulkner was trying to do, was trying
that's
to
not
regulate.
True, is it? Not anybody
what
can go to Switzerland.
Dying. Well, they can with the money. I've got some questions.
That's not true. If I took an elderly relative to Switzerland against their will and assisted their death in the Dignitas clinic in a lay by.
You'd be prosecuted afterwards, but not before that.
No,
gone.
I'm very anxious now. That now the law is clarified, that people's intentions to do things are examined before they go.
Well, that's exactly what we are. We think we agree on something at last, because we think that the regulation would mean that there are safeguards up front before people have an assisted death, not after somebody has died.
Those famous stringent conditions to which you refer in Oregon, Holland and Switzerland.
The crux of the issue really, though, is about proportionality of sentencing. And, you know, does George think that Omar Puente, Debbie Purdy's husband, should get 14 years in prison if he does end up accompanying her to Switzerland? Does he think that's proportionate?
Well, your understanding of the law, Sarah, is as limited as your understanding
yes
of the medical
or no,
profession.
Yes, as you said to me earlier. No.
Because the law is demonstrably applied compassionately and with discretion. The fact is that what you want to do is to open the floodgates to any old Tom, Dick and Harry who can take whoever they like to Switzerland to kill them.
No, I want to introduce safeguards. I mean, actually, it's interesting because research shows that if you have a proportionate sentencing that people are certainly going to end up with...
Proportionate sentencing is exercised. Then Kay Gildedale was not convicted.
But these people, as I say, Frances Inglis ended up with a life sentence.
Well, rightly so.
There's an accompaniment.
You know better than the jury that convicted her.
A
supporter
of Bin Laden, who this week was convicted of terrorism activities, has got 9 years. Do you really think what Frances Inglis did is equivalent to that?
Well, what I am saying is that these cases should be tested before the law, not before some kind of we're going to have to draw the discussion
to a close there. Let me first of all, though, as we have some concluding thoughts on today's programme, bring in Paul Baddon. Paul, thank you for joining us by phone today from Cardiff. Paul, ultimately you feel, I guess, that assisted dying is the humane, is the Christian thing to do in circumstances which, if you like, that is the best option for a person to relieve their suffering.
Yes, where a person is suffering unbearably in the final stages of terminal illness and repeatedly asks for assistance to die, I believe that the Christian law of loving compassion should enable us to respond to such a request. And I do not think there are any real dangers in allowing that to happen. And I would urge all readers to go online and look at the World Health Organization statistics in relation to the amount of money spent on healthcare, life expectancy rates, number of hospital beds, things like that, and compare countries which allow assisted dying and those that don't. And you will find that better healthcare is available in countries that allow it than in countries which forbid it.
Thank you for joining us today on the programme, Paul. And if you want to get a copy of Paul's book, Is There a Christian Case for Assisted Suicide? Again, look for the link with today's podcast at premier.org.uk/unbelievable. George, we'll put a link up there to your book as well. As a final thought from yourself, obviously you start out your book saying that you feel that where we've arrived now is kind of a result of a sort of commodity. The making human life a commodity, something that we can sort of choose what we do with it, when we do with it.
Yes, Sarah talks about, you know, power as if personal autonomy is about the exercise of power. Later, I'm going to join a demonstration against the proposed execution in Florida of Linda Carty. Most people in this country, when they're surveyed, are in favour of capital punishment. I'm firmly against capital punishment because I think it's a council of despair. I think it has no redemption and no hope in it. My major criticisms, ultimately, of where Paul Badham is, where Dignity in Dying is, where Sarah Wootton is that they offer no hope. They offer no redemption. They offer no sense that life is to be, every life is to be cherished. Their solution, ultimately, for dying people in extremis is to make them die. I think we've got a better future, and I think that's about hope and redemption.
Finally, Sarah, do you want to just a few...
Well, I do think this campaign is about power and who makes the decisions for others. So if you're listening and supportive and you want to help, then please look at Dignity in Dying's website, which is dignityindying.org.uk, or look at our partner charity, compassionindying.org.uk, which I said earlier provides information about people's rights at the end of life. My thought is that to accede to someone's request for an assisted death is not to devalue human life, not to devalue their particular human life, and it's not colluding in someone's devaluing of their own life. It's actually accepting their valuation that the few remaining days or weeks of their life that they don't want to endure. So for me and for many others like us, in the final days or weeks of someone's life, if somebody wants to control the manner and timing of their death within safeguards, and if there are healthcare professionals willing to help them, who are we to stop them?
Thanks to all my guests today, Sarah Wootton of Dignity in Dying, Reverend George Pitcher, Anglican priest, and Paul Badham, another Anglican priest who joined me on the programme today. Hope you enjoyed this week's Blast from the Past, our midweek classic replay. And for more from Unbelievable, including our blogs, our videos, an archive of past shows, do check out the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.